the U.S. Several other Democratic lawmakers, including other members of the group of legislators, collectively known as the Squad, signed on as co-sponsors of the bill. Both Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi have called on Vice President Mike Pence to begin the process of invoking the 25th Amendment, which would empower him and a majority of the president's cabinet to remove Trump from power. If Pence doesn't pursue this road, both Democratic leaders have signaled they could try to immediately remove the president from the office themselves. If the vice president and the cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment, Pelosi said in a statement on Thursday, January 8. Impeachment, rather than the 25th Amendment, could prevent Trump from holding federal office again. According to Article 1, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution, the Senate can, in addition to removing a person from office, also disqualify an individual from being able to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States.
The United States is still reeling from what happened at the heart of the American democracy in the capital of the nation on Wednesday. The unprecedented chaos in Washington, D.C. has been described by many as a shattering blow to the image of America. The extent of polarization of the American society was on full display on Wednesday. Supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump, encouraged by him, marched to the Capitol building as the Congress was meeting to confirm Joe Biden's election victory. Chaotic scenes erupted as Trump supporters clashed with security forces and stormed the Capitol building. The violent mayhem temporarily blocked the counting of the Electoral College votes. Several people lost their lives inside and outside the Congress building. Trump, who has repeated claims of a stolen election, was widely condemned for inciting violence in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday.
What led to this one has been, in terms of its most recent context, 4 years of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump lying to the American people about a number of things, but most recently lying to the American people about the election and the fact that that he won in his mind.
The storming of the Capitol building triggered a number of resignations from Trump's team less than 2 weeks before the outgoing president's term will be over. Meanwhile, senior Democrats are calling for Trump to be removed immediately. They want him to be forced out of office now, either under the disability clause of the 25th Amendment or through an impeachment. 4 years of Trump's divisive presidency seems to have fueled different divisions in the American society to an unprecedented level. The unprecedented violence in Washington, D.C. will undoubtedly be hard for America to recover from. Soon after the storming of the Capitol building by his supporters, Trump committed to an orderly transition of power later this month. But the damage is done. The bitter developments of this week seem to have hugely dented the credibility of America's democracy. Meanwhile, Wednesday's events in Washington drew reactions from around the world. Some countries went so far as to say that the chaos exposed internal collapse in the American political system and that the events showed Western democracy is fragile and broken.
America has been championing this fraud that America is the, as Ronald Reagan said, the shining city on the hill, And, you know, we profess to be the bastion of democracy, but the best way that America seems to be able to bring democracy to other places is at the barrel of a gun. And so what I honestly believe that this has done is it has exposed the hypocrisy of America.
American officials have long lectured the leaders of other countries on democratic values and peaceful transfer of power from one elected president to another. Americans have been very proud of peaceful and smooth handover of government every 4 years, but that did not happen this time. Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections. One recent opinion poll shows more than half of Republican voters believe Trump rightfully won the election. That's tens of millions of Americans that don't trust the election result. The incoming administration of Joe Biden will face many domestic and foreign challenges. But right now, perhaps leading a divided America will probably be the toughest task facing the future president of the United States.
Defend the Constitution.
Saudi Arabia, in a U-turn on its diplomatic course, has decided to lift its land, air, and sea blockade on Qatar following more than 3 years of a standoff between the two countries. The decision was announced at a Persian Gulf Cooperation Council summit held in the Saudi city of Al Ula. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said the kingdom signed a rapprochement agreement with Qatar along with Oman and Kuwait. The prince, a de facto ruler, hailed the agreement, saying the attending nations reaffirmed their Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability. He also thanked the United States and Kuwait for their mediation. The deal, however, seems to be pursuing nothing but an anti-Iran policy by Riyadh. During the summit, MBS repeated the kingdom's anti-Tehran rhetoric, saying there was a desperate need to unite their efforts to what he called develop the West Asia region and confront challenges, especially those posed by Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile program. The Saudi-Qatar rapprochement comes more than 3 years after Riyadh, along with its regional hawks, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt, cut their diplomatic and economic ties with Doha. They sealed their borders and expelled Qatari citizens from their countries. They accused Doha of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. Qatar, however, strongly rejected those allegations, arguing that it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for reconciliation. Qatar, however, did not publicly bow to any of their demands. But what has really caused the Saudi regime to lift this blockade on Qatar and resettle relations with Doha at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump, one of Saudi's main backers in the international coalition against Iran, is leaving office within weeks?
At this point, the Saudi Arabian government knows that Trump is leaving office shortly, and the Biden administration will not be quite as sympathetic to its rogue activities as the Trump administration has been. So for this reason, Saudi Arabia wants to reestablish or at least normalize its ties with Qatar, and that's the reason for them doing this at this time.
While the reconciliation agreement between Saudi Arabia and Qatar is still preliminary in nature, questions arise as to why Riyadh makes a sudden U-turn in its approach toward Doha. Observers say Saudi Arabia is pursuing its own interests.
Saudi Arabia is certainly pursuing its own interests. It isn't acting in the interests of that region of the world or of Qatar, but it does see that the end of the U.S. government's permission to do whatever it chooses is in sight. Also, the Saudi Arabian government realizes that this blockade has not been effective. Qatar has not given in to any of the 13 demands that Saudi Arabia issued when it started this in 2017. So it's been a complete failure. So in order to save face, perhaps, and also to perhaps curry favor with the Biden administration, it is at this time reestablishing these relations with Qatar.
The latest Saudi posture comes in the backdrop of its growing nexus with the Israeli regime. It is no more a secret that the kingdom is seeking to normalize relations with Israel. That came into the spotlight, especially after Donald Trump's senior advisor, Jared Kushner, said a normalization agreement between Riyadh and Tel Aviv was very imminent. Even the recent U.S. brokered normalization between some Arab countries, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco with Israel, could not have been possible without the Saudi blessing. All in all, what looks to be true is the fact that Saudi Arabia is seeking to establish an anti-Iran front to stand against the Iranian influence in the region.
Because of the recent Arab countries that have established ties with Israel, Saudi Arabia would like to see Qatar join them and then have a more unified front against Iran. However, these nations aren't as willing to demonize Iran as Saudi Arabia is, as the United States is. They see, and Qatar would see, any affiliation with Israel as unrelated to its alliance with Iran.
Riyadh has long accused the Islamic Republic of seeking to destabilize the region. But one may question, isn't it Riyadh that has constantly pursued the policy of fueling regional tensions? From maintaining its interference in Libya and Bahrain, Riyadh has also imposed a full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen, killing and maiming tens of thousands of civilians over the past 6 years. What one may also question is how far the Saudi regime seeking to expose its hegemonic agenda in West Asia and beyond.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state, and flipping the state is a great testament to our country.
These are the words of the U.S. president, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. military, and a man that just 4 years ago took a pledge echoed by his forefathers to uphold the law and constitution of the United States of America, and a man that wanted to continue for another 4 years, with Trump essentially asking the Secretary of State for Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, to break the law and find nearly 12,000 votes. The prompt reply from the official was clear. Georgia's results are correct. Trump then went on to explain that voter fraud was a serious crime, and then had the audacity to threaten the official by claiming he was taking a huge risk by breaking the law. Irony at its very finest, it seems.
The ballots are corrupt, and you're going to find that they are, which is totally illegal. It's more illegal for you than it is for them, because you know what they did and you're not reporting it. That's a criminal offense. And you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk.
Is Trump then breaking the law himself by asking for votes to be found?
I think it is a criminal activity. I think he was clearly pressing an a government official to alter the vote count. That would be illegal under federal law and also under Georgia state law. United States says the national laws and the state laws. What are the chances of the federal law being applied to him? Trump can, of course, give himself a blanket pardon for just about everything. He probably will.
Since the election results were announced, Donald Trump has been contesting the figures and making unsubstantiated allegations of electoral fraud, much of which he believes comes from the postal votes cast by voters worried about voting in person due to the COVID-19 virus.
It's essentially, if they did this, which we have no proof of, we have claim after claim after claim with zero proof. Zero.
Trump's behavior has sparked an angry reaction from multiple leading officials, most notably 10 previous defense secretaries of both Republican and Democrat views, who have urged Trump to drop the notion that the election was not fair and accept defeat with grace. Some of Trump's most staunch supporters, however, have continued to attempt to override the decision, with the likes of Ted Cruz and 10 other senators trying to get Congress to reject the clarification of the result due on the 6th of January. Yet even this is being met by resistance from other leading Republicans. Donald Trump has made it no secret of his clear distaste for Iran. The reason? Simply because Iran chose not to conform with the so-called American way, and hence saw the president remove the US from the JCPOA, assassinate Iran's leading military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and place sanctions on Iran that constituted nothing short of economic terrorism. Along with his ailing ally Benjamin Netanyahu, the Trump and Israeli regime have longed to start a conflict with Iran, in particular over the last 4 years with Trump as president. But as his time comes to an end, will Trump use a conflict with Iran in a last-ditch effort to stay in power, a move that would still guarantee nothing?
Well, I don't think so. Trump is a very erratic figure, though. I've been hearing that there's imminent war with Iran for 10, 15 years now, and there have been some nasty acts about that, the sanctions, assassinations. But a full attack on Iran, I don't think Trump will do that. There's too much headwind from the Joint Chiefs, the generals, and the admirals. They don't want it.
Yet the U.S. military themselves are very wary about possible actions and decisions taken by Trump, with the same 10 former defense secretaries who told Trump to accept the election result also stating that entering the U.S. armed forces into a military dispute would be dangerous, unlawful, and unconstitutional. For Iran, however, the departure of Trump spells a victory and an embarrassing defeat for Trump, as the nation stood firmly against the maximum pressure policy, overcame sanctions through national unity and production, and saw leaders, such as Lieutenant General Soleimani, successfully defeat the U.S.-backed Daesh group, paving the way for a retreat of U.S. forces in the region. With Trump having shown throughout his term the ability to make and act on so many irrational decisions, it appears that the 45th President of the United States is truly on the edge of reason and about to leave a legacy of nothing but lies, deceit, and humiliation.
January the 3rd marked the first anniversary since the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and deputy head of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were assassinated in a U.S. drone strike. The strike, which also killed a number of their companions near Baghdad International Airport, was carried out under the authorization of U.S. President Donald Trump. Both commanders were deeply revered and respected in the region, particularly due to their efforts to fight terrorism and their key roles in eliminating Daesh from Iraq and Syria. Events were held in Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere in the region to commemorate and pay tributes to the two anti-terror commanders and demand their revenge.
We've seen even a tweet, a message being sent out by the ex-president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, sending his condolences to the people of Iran and the people, the free peoples of the world, and calling Soleimani a hero of the anti-imperialist struggle. This is the reason that people come out in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Palestine, commemorating the martyrdom of these great men.
In statements made on the occasion of first anniversary of the assassination, Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movements asserted that the resistance front will continue down the same path set by General Qasem Soleimani. People in Iraq also held nationwide rallies as well as a ceremony at Baghdad Airport to pay homage to the slain commanders. Calls for the ouster of foreign troops from the Iraqi soil strengthened following the U.S. assassination of Iran and Iraq's top anti-terrorism commanders in Baghdad. Following the attacks, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Numerous rallies and protests have also been held across the country since with the same demands. Washington has so far transferred several Iraqi military bases back to local forces, with senior U.S. military officials saying local forces are increasingly able to counter terrorism on their own. The head of Pentagon's Central Command said last year that the number of U.S. troops in West Asia
including Iraq and Syria, would most likely be reduced soon. The top commander, however, said he expected US and NATO forces to maintain a long-term presence in Iraq to both help what he called fighting terrorism and checking Iranian influence in the country.
The US, who is staying occupying Iraq because it needs to make sure the resources of this abundant land are not going to the liberation of Arab and Muslim peoples from the yoke of colonization and imperialism. And it's also there to make sure there is no natural continuity between the peoples of the region that have been together for thousands of years, the Iranian peoples and the Arab peoples that have coexisted and coagulated their cultures for centuries. So that is what's happening, and the United States will not leave if it doesn't face resistance to its occupation.
But what has prompted the United States to reduce its troops in the region? Some experts say Trump wants to deliver his 2016 campaign promise of bringing back American forces from abroad. But others believe that Washington is losing its footprint in West Asia as calls for expelling U.S. forces by regional nations have grown stronger than ever.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
By manufacturing an oil crisis in Yemen, Saudi Arabia is able to foment political chaos in the country and stir up popular discontent against domestic oil companies, says Ahmad Abdul Karim Ryder in an article published under the heading, A Manufactured Crisis, How Saudi Arabia Uses Oil to Bring Yemen to Its Knees. Stay tuned for the details, please. Yemen's oil is enthralled to a complex, intertwined network of elites that control the smuggling of fuel imports and new thriving black markets. Starving Yemen of petroleum products has always been a conspicuous feature of Saudi Arabia's nearly six-year-long invasion of the country. However, the most recent blockade is significantly more extensive than previous ones and comes at a time when a pandemic, diseases, and hunger are spreading rapidly across Yemen. The most recent byproducts of that blockade, the spread of schistosomiasis, a faltering economy in areas outside of Saudi control, and a dangerous new black market. Known colloquially as snail fever, schistosomiasis is a rare disease caused by flatworms that thrive in untreated water, something now abundant in Yemen, as the diesel fuel needed to power many of the country's water treatment facilities, especially those in rural areas far removed from any electric grid, has dried up amid the blockade. In a remote village in Al Marwa district, Khaled Abdo looks at his thin daughter, 12-year-old Jamila, with heartbreak as she lies still in the family's hut. Jamila is suffering from abdominal pain, diarrhea, and blood in her stool. Khaled said she has worms in her stomach, now distended and bloated in stark contrast to her otherwise meager frame. Jamila was later diagnosed with schistosomiasis, according to her family, leaving her with just 3 to 10 more years of life if she doesn't receive proper medical care, a luxury in her war-torn country. As the war in Yemen closes in on yet another grim milestone, the end of its sixth year in March, oil-rich U.S. ally Saudi Arabia continues to prevent oil tankers from delivering much-needed fuel to hospitals, water pumping stations, bakeries, cleaning trucks, and gas stations, plunging the entire nation into an unending fuel crisis. The CEO of Yemen Petroleum Company, Ammar al-Adrai, told Min Press that at least 9 tankers have been trapped in Saudi Arabia's Jizan port, which sits on the kingdom's western seaboard, painfully close to the Yemeni border. The tankers, al-Adrai says, have been held despite being checked and issued permits by both the Saudi-led coalition and the United Nations. He confirmed that the vessels are loaded with oil derivatives and that some of them have been detained for over 9 months, leading to the suspension of more than 50% of the operational capabilities in the service, health, industrial, and commercial sectors. That lack of fuel has caused an acute shortage of even the most basic goods. Khaled told Min Press that the price of fruits, vegetables, and medicine is skyrocketing and my farm is defenseless against desertification. Like many farmers, Khaled, who like his daughter Jamila shows symptoms of malnutrition, is unable to power the pumps needed to irrigate his fields, leaving him unable to grow his own food with which to feed his family and the desert sands encroaching on his now derelict fields. At least 80% of Yemen's 28 million strong population is reliant on food aid to survive in what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and the decimation of the remaining agricultural sector is likely to increase that figure. The Yemeni government is indifferent and apathetic to the suffering of citizens, even in areas under their control, Khaled said, accusing the Saudi-backed government of Aden of deliberately compounding the suffering through the proliferation of the black market. Fuel shortages in the northern provinces are caused by the blockade, but in Aden we don't understand what's going on. By manufacturing an oil crisis in Yemen, Saudi Arabia is able to foment political chaos in the country and stir up popular discontent against domestic oil companies. As a sort of grim bonus, the manufactured oil shortages also to incapitate the port of Hodeidah, increasing poverty and unemployment rates and siphoning cash out of the market, according to the Yemen Petroleum Company, YPC. YPC released a statement placing the estimated economic damage caused by Saudi Arabia's refusal to allow tankers to unload their cargo at billions of U.S. dollars. The company also said that the demurrage fees are now at an unprecedented level of nearly $107 million and that Saudi forces have illegally impounded 72 Yemen-bound oil tankers last year, resulting in an approximately 45% drop in the amount of desperately needed fuel shipments arriving at Yemeni ports. The fuel blockade has not only forced thousands of Yemenis to wait for days in lines as far as the eye can see, but it has also left water pumps and treatment plants and hospital generators without fuel. Most drinking water, particularly in rural areas, is extracted using diesel-powered pumps, while the country's sizable refugee population survives on water brought by diesel-powered trucks. Food imports, which generally arrive via one of the country's ports, are processed and packaged at diesel fuel powered facilities, factories in Hodeida or Aden, before being transported across the country or sold locally. Outside of the country's coastal cities, where more than 60% of the population resides, freight is transported by road, leaving remote communities at the mercy of trucks that must traverse roads pockmarked and damaged by airstrikes. The few who are willing to undertake the dangerous journey must contend with the high price and scant availability of fuel, pushing the price and availability of even the most basic commodities, including food, water, and medicines, through the roof. The oil crisis in Yemen certainly isn't new, but it has been growing worse recently amid a black market boom, which is adding to the already miserable quality of life for Yemenis. The Saudi regime is flooding southern areas of Yemen under its control with cheap fuel, exacerbating regional tensions and creating an ideal environment for black market petroleum products to boom. The stark disparity between the availability of fuel in Saudi-controlled areas versus areas under Ansarullah control is also causing predictable economic damage to the latter, which is unable to compete amid the Saudi-imposed blockade. Despite the suffocating siege on the country, petrol products are sold illegally on roadsides, streets, and isolated areas in the south and north of the country alike, often at double the official price, with prices in some areas reach 11,000 riyals for 20 liters. These black market petrol products are mixed with water and other materials and enter from Saudi-controlled ports in Aden Port and border crossings such as Al-Wariya, Al-Sahar, and the rich oil Ma'rib province. Yemen's oil is now in large part controlled by a complex network of corrupt officials that control the smuggling routes, imports, and black market sales. Many members of these elite groups are also key allies of Saudi Arabia and the UAE regimes. They not only plunder the wealth and destroy the economy, but they put people's lives and property in danger. People are now forced to seek their fuel from shady black market dealers and store fuel in their homes to get them through tough times. Smuggled petroleum products are sold in residential areas and on licensed storefronts that do not meet security and safety standards and exacerbate the human cost of the crisis.
President-elect Joe Biden has formally announced many of his cabinet picks boasting the most diverse cabinet in United States history. So who are these appointees? What are their records? And what are we really going to see from this incoming administration? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Joe Biden, whose campaign was practically dead in the water barely a year ago during the Democratic primaries, is now the president-elect of the United States. Things took a surprising turn when, during the Democratic primaries, several candidates all dropped out simultaneously and pledged their support behind Joe Biden, making the race a de facto head-to-head between him and Bernie Sanders. This Machiavellian move, with Obama making a few phone calls behind the scenes, cemented Joe Biden's status as the so-called frontrunner and saw the race narrow in his favor. Bernie Sanders soon dropped out and, just like he did in 2016, rallied behind the Democratic nominee without any opposition, rolling over and abandoning his grassroots movement of workers without obtaining any policy concessions from Biden. Bernie Sanders supporters and the progressive wing of the party were told once again that they absolutely needed to vote for the Democratic nominee for Biden because Donald Trump was an existential threat to the United States and that Biden was somehow the lesser of two evils. The Democratic Party knew it could count on them. It knew it could count on millions of Bernie supporters who had been sheepdogged back into the party. So why bother appeasing the left? Instead, we saw the Democratic Party invite neocon war criminals like Colin Powell to speak at their convention. The formation of groups like Republicans for Biden. Or even worse, the heinous Lincoln Project, a group of neoconservative war criminals from the Bush era like Rick Wilson, Bill Kristol, and Dick Cheney's daughter, making the case for Joe Biden. In essence, the Democratic Party and Biden's campaign tried more to appeal to right-wing voters and Republicans than to the left wing of their own party because no one was pressuring them from the left. And besides, that's exactly what Democrats are anyway. They are right-wingers. Even policies supported by most Americans, both Republican and Democrat, like universal health care, were frowned upon by Biden. Biden flat out said that he would veto Medicare for All. Just looking at Joe Biden's record, having spent 40 years in Congress catering to credit card companies, to Wall Street, to the fossil fuel industry, authoring the 94 crime bill and jailing scores of young African-American men, helping to start the Iraq War and supporting virtually every U.S. military intervention, Joe Biden even shamelessly bragged about working with segregationists. Despite all of this, Americans were told that they needed to blindly pledge their vote for Joe Biden in order to get rid of Trump. We heard over and over how Americans must put aside their grievances, shut up, and vote for the blue war criminal because he was supposedly different from the red war criminal. In the words of Joe Biden's own wife, voters were told to swallow a little. All of this under the premise that once Joe Biden was elected, voters would be able to push him left. So here we are, months later, Joe Biden has won and been declared president-elect. And already he's walked back several of his campaign promises, including canceling student loan debts and rolling back Trump's immigration policies. Not only that, but he's made several key appointments to his cabinet, many of them familiar faces, old pals from the Obama days. The same people who took the United States from two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to seven wars in Syria, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, and Pakistan. The same people who expanded the NSA's mass surveillance programs, who sold billions of dollars to the Saudi Arabian regime in order to commit genocide in Yemen. The same people who dismantled the anti-war and Occupy movements. The same people who gave bailouts to Wall Street while forcing millions of Americans out of their homes. The same corporatist criminals and their neoliberal policies who led to Trump in the first place. So while Trump picked a cabinet of crooks who were DC outsiders, Biden also picks a bunch of crooks, but at least they're DC insiders. In fact, this very much pleases the liberal elites and the corporate establishment media. Why? Because of diversity, allegedly. Joe Biden bragged that his cabinet is the most diverse in United States history. These appointments have, of course, been lauded and praised by the mainstream media because they mean nothing in terms of structural change and have no effect on the goals of the U.S. empire. The liberal elites and the media establishment can continue to pretend that they celebrate minorities and people of color while oppressing those very same groups, both at home and abroad, under the veil of intersectional, rainbow-colored imperialism. So far, Joe Biden has appointed seven women to his White House communications team. He also appointed Neera Tanden to head the Office of Management and Budget. This is the same Neera Tanden, Clinton aide, who suggested in an email that Arab countries should pay the United States with their oil for invading them. Biden has tapped Avril Haines as the Director of National Intelligence, a former deputy director of the CIA and an architect of Obama's horrific drone program, which has killed countless civilians across the Middle East. But I guess we shouldn't worry, right? Because she's a woman, and according to the New York Times, she's also a brown belt in judo, a pilot, and turned an old bar into a bookstore. Biden's foreign policy advisor, Tony Blinken, will now be his Secretary of State. Blinken is another familiar face from the Obama administration and a supporter of the imperialist wars on Libya, Syria, and Yemen. He signaled that Biden would continue to use the Caesar Act sanctions, keep U.S. troops inside of Syria, and continue occupying Syria's oil, just as Trump has done. Yet according to The Guardian, these minor transgressions should be overlooked because Blinken can apparently speak French and play the guitar. So I'm sure this will be very appreciated by many Syrians who are currently starving under America's sanctions. Or what about Biden's pick for U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, an African-American woman who also happens to serve as the vice president on leave to a Swiss mining company called Glencore, which is currently facing corruption charges in the Democratic Republic of Congo. These are just a few of the wonderful imperialists and corporatists that Joe Biden has appointed to his cabinet under the banner of so-called diversity. So joining me to discuss these cabinet picks further is Kevin Gostola, journalist and managing editor at Shadowproof. It's good to have you on, Kevin. How are you?
Yeah, thank you.
Kevin, you've been doing some great coverage on Joe Biden's new cabinet picks. We've been seeing a lot of familiar faces from the Obama days. Is that just a coincidence?
Well, what we're seeing are the people who have the leadership in the Democratic Party, the people who are going to be boosted. That's an amalgamation of Clinton Democrats, and then you have Obama Democrats. These are kind of the establishment factions that have sort of been at war with each other. Well, they've always had a shared interest to suppress any kind of insurgency from the wing of the party that I usually call the Sanders wing or the Sanders Democrats or maybe the Justice Democrats. And so politically, that's what we see happening. And, you know, to be quite honest, the progressives just really don't have much power to match the influence of the Obama Democrats or the Clinton Democrats. And so what you have is, especially when it comes to foreign policy, you have, you know, the weakest of appeals to liberal imperialism, basically. Like, it's the yeah. disagreements, the arguments are over whether you're going to have a more humanitarian kind of foreign policy that is still interventionist, or you're going to just ditch human rights entirely and show force and wield it with a kind of iron fist globally. And so what you're getting now is the alternative brand of U.S. empire that Biden is about to put forward. We've had 4 years of Donald Trump. We've seen what that could do. It turned off the entire globe, but that doesn't mean that what we're going to get from Joe Biden is going to necessarily be, you know, peace and human rights.
Speaking of foreign policy and empire specifically, can you tell us a bit more about Biden's new defense secretary? We're hearing praise from the media that he is the first black man to lead the Pentagon.
His name is Lloyd Austin, and he's a remarkable figure because it seems like no matter what in the United States, you can't keep people out of our government who have passed in the Iraq War. Lloyd Austin is the fact that he was involved in leading the invasion of Iraq and has boasted about going so quickly from, I believe, Kuwait to the Baghdad city in like a record amount of time. He was able to move forces and go in there and seize Baghdad. And this is his, what he considers to be the most honorable part of his military career, if you read it. And then he pairs it, I think disingenuously, with being involved in the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. However, he and Joe Biden and other Democrats are terrible at how they spin the Iraq withdrawal, because those troops were only, for the most part, removed expeditiously because they were afraid that the Iraqi government was going to start holding U.S. soldiers accountable for war crimes, which was a thing that was a sticking point to a status of forces agreement. So any work that was done to ultimately remove troops from Iraq, first off, I don't see that being like, hey, a tribute to you for removing forces that shouldn't have been there in the first place. It's like, they, like, it's like, okay, you led this and you know how to remove invaders from a foreign country. Like, great.
Right.
But then there's the issue of the fact that he was at a company called United Technologies that within the last year completed a merger with Raytheon and is now part of one of the biggest weapons manufacturers in the world. There is some truth to the fact that, like, I shouldn't treat him any differently than other Pentagon secretaries. So we've heard that he's a black man, and we should be excited because we're going to have the first black Pentagon secretary in United States history. Okay, but he's also the first black Pentagon military industrial complex leader of the entire world. You know, that's his claim. That's going to be his claim to fame too. And he'll be following in the footsteps of Mark Esper and James Mattis and Patrick Shanahan, who were Trump's defense secretaries, and they all came from defense contractors or weapons companies. In fact, Mark Esper, who he's succeeding, came from Raytheon. So it's as if Raytheon has completely taken control of the Pentagon. Essentially, the revolving door isn't even really a revolving door anymore. It's just a complete pipeline from Raytheon to the Pentagon in order for it to funnel money into the coffers of Raytheon for the bombing of children in Yemen or wherever Saudi Arabia might need us to assist them in the Middle East next.
Kevin, thank you so much for your amazing reporting, your insight, and all your analysis. I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So, Kevin, what about all these women that Biden has appointed as well? Because the mainstream media is saying we should all be happy that he's putting so many women in key positions of power. However, when you look at the records, Avril Haines, for example, you know, Joe Biden boasts that he has the most diverse cabinet. But what does that mean in this case? What kind of diversity are we really talking about here?
I'd like to give a nod to a journalist who I recently had the opportunity to interview, Roberto Lovato. There's a fantastic book right now on the violence and the interconnectedness of El Salvador and the United States. But he calls this intersectional empire. And that's what we're seeing under Joe Biden, is that we're bringing in all these figures to just have a more multicultural kind of an empire. You know, it's basically going to be an empire that looks like our country. And that's something that people are going to have to confront head on and stop falling for appointing, you know, women or Latinos or gays and lesbians or transgender people. You know, like, without going too far away from, I want to highlight Avril Haines specifically because I think she deserves attention, but without going too far away, there's actually a transgender person who was on his agency review team for the Biden transition. And I couldn't help but laugh because it's a transgender person who's a vet, but it's also somebody who's a contractor for CACI, which was involved in the Abu Ghraib torture scandal, was implicated in... So the representation that transgender people are getting in Biden's transition is coming from a contractor guilty of torture in Iraq. That's not representation, I think. I think we have to be clear here. I'm not trying to denigrate any group of people, but I'm saying if you really want representation, you need to be putting more demands on political elites, because what you don't want is reinforcing the white heteronormative patriarchy. And I think, like, it's fair to put it that way, because what they're doing is they're weaponizing you against people around the world. And so you have Avril Haines, who's coming in. The director of national intelligence position is what she's been picked to be a part of. And she's significant because she is a John Brennan loyalist. She was at the CIA. She was involved in further entrenching the assassination complex for drone warfare and the kill list. She's involved in, you know, they celebrate her as if, like, she was concerned about international law and she forced them to have a better process and to do more and then just quit killing people every Terror Tuesday with reckless abandon. But what this means is that it just became a more formal part of U.S. government. It was no longer easy to question what Barack Obama was doing. I mean, as he even admits in his latest memoir, he talks about how, like, easy it was to be killing people, essentially. And so, you know, that's what she was involved in. And she came from Palantir, too. She was at Palantir, which is... a major security contractor that is implicated in, like, the deportations of immigrants. And the thing that's remarkable, too, is she was at a think tank called CNAS that is funded by oil companies, weapons companies, but it also got money from the Director of National Intelligence, that office which she is now going to be a chair of or running as a director. And then it also received money from Palantir. So it's just amazing. Like, when you think about the revolving doors of these people, it's just so incestuous.
So speaking of actually obtaining something substantive, what are progressives getting from this administration and these cabinet picks? People were told that they have to vote for Joe Biden, that he's the lesser of two evils, and once he's elected, you can push him left. Okay, well, I don't see Bernie Sanders' name anywhere on this list. So what are progressives getting exactly from this administration?
The only thing that I think you could say we might gain from a Biden administration is that we won't be bombing Iran. But we also know that we were never going to do that unless the Pentagon changed its calculus, because they've always had their own analysis that says that they would never be able to succeed militarily the way they want to. And so that's always held them back from doing more than just, like, enlisting Israel to go assassinate nuclear scientists or engaging in cyber warfare with things like Stuxnet to just completely dismantle the infrastructure. That's Barack Obama. That's where Joe Biden is going next. We're going to see that kind of hybrid warfare. And so I think people really need to be aware that what we have now with a Joe Biden administration is a ramping up of tensions with Russia, a ramping up of tensions with China. The great power competition is going to be extremely fierce. And then with Iran, like, I don't know what they're supposed to do. The government and all the officials didn't do anything wrong when it came to the nuclear deal. Donald Trump decided to completely scrap it. And then now, somehow, in order to get the U.S. back into it, I'm afraid that Joe Biden's going to force Iran to make some kind of concessions, even though they never left the deal. So why should they have to do it? Like, why should they have to be the ones that give anything up? It should be the United States that gives Iran something in order to be back in the nuclear deal, in order to have this agreement. And so I think you asked the right question, which is, what are progressives gaining from this cabinet when it comes to foreign policy? I mean, look at the bill that just passed for the government that had the stimulus package. It contains funding for democracy promotion programs. It contains funding for more of the intervention and regime change operations in Venezuela. It contains funding for the war on drugs in the Caribbean. It contains funding for helping activists continue to destabilize Hong Kong just so that they can drive a wedge between China and any other countries in the region that it's trying to work with and cooperate with. And so I'm really concerned here. And then the other thing with these people who are in the cabinet that we have to address is that they're completely hawkish on Syria and favor arms being sent to Syria. And also, you've had situations where the Pentagon's funding their own groups that end up going to war with CIA-funded groups. So it's a total satire.
Right. I mean, these pics are total jokes. Pete Buttigieg, a small-town mayor, he's now the transport secretary. The former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, you know, her field of so-called expertise is predominantly foreign policy, yet now she'll be leading the domestic policy council. What are all these weird picks? Is there something transactional or nefarious going on here as opposed to something based on expertise?
It's transactional. And let me just disclose that I'm actually from the same hometown area that Pete Buttigieg is from. So I have a little insight into the fact that, you know, as far as his transportation experience, he really has none. But what I can tell you is there's a commuter train that runs between that area. There's a commuter train that runs between Chicago and northern Indiana that now he'll be able to use the same way that Mitch McConnell's wife was able to use as transportation secretary. So you know what this means is that he'll be able to jump to the front of line and get federal grants funneled to northern Indiana ahead of every other part of the United States. So it's just going to be an opportunity for Pete Buttigieg to get the gravy train going and put him in a good spot so that he can run for president again and make everybody feel good that he did a nice job as transportation secretary. Meanwhile, he has no knowledge of these systems. And then you raise the issue of Susan Rice. She couldn't get confirmed in a Senate. She never could get confirmed in the Senate because of what she did in Libya. So what are they going to do? Give her a domestic policy council position, which has nothing to do with her field of expertise at all.
I think it's frankly hilarious that anyone would expect anything different from a candidate who told rich donors that nothing would fundamentally change. We can clearly see that Joe Biden is not only returning the favor to those who stood aside for him to clinch the presidency, but just like all presidents before him, he is catering to the military-industrial complex, Wall Street, and the rest of corporate America. Once again, we see the formation of a cabinet run not by the American people, but by the oligarchy and multinational corporations. Joe Biden may be appointing all these women, women of color, people of color, to his cabinet. His cabinet might be diverse in race, orientation, and gender, but it is by no means diverse in terms of policy. What's the point of having a black Secretary of Defense if he's going to keep bombing black and brown people on the other side of the planet? What's the point of appointing a woman Director of National Intelligence if she helps drone strike and displace other women? You know, if Biden cares about women, wouldn't it have been better to not support the Saudi-led genocide in Yemen that has forced critical essential services and clinics to shut down, leaving scores of women without the necessary medical services that they require? As Eric London writes a few weeks ago, quote, "These servants of Wall Street and U.S. imperialism have nothing in common with the working people of their own race, gender, or sexual orientation. It is class, not identity, which is the fundamental dividing line in American society." This intersectional imperialism is just a facade in order to continue the same brutal policies of the U.S. empire, exploiting workers, killing and robbing people of color, all for the enrichment of the corporate elites. This pandering is an attempt to portray Biden's incoming administration as being more inclusive and diverse, implying that its tenure will be more in tune to the needs of these same minorities. But at the end of the day, these cabinet picks are all part of the same DC clique. They've spent their entire careers serving corporate interests and climbing the political ladder, and the last thing on their minds is serving the needs of their constituents, never mind those of their same race, gender, or orientation. many people around the globe are rightfully cautious and skeptical about anything changing under Biden, and very conscious of the fact that the American empire continues just as it is, regardless of who is in the driver's seat. It's time, perhaps, for Americans to wake up to that as well. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Rich.